You know what's really funny about Viktor Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning, by the way, just to get back to our initial topic a little bit, is that Frankl, the philosopher that Frankl mentions most often, may surprise you, was Friedrich Nietzsche. Not normally who you'd think of as the person to carry you through tough times. I think of the Stoics, or maybe the Christians, but certainly not Nietzsche. But anyway, Dan Stewart says, I've sent Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning to friends in prison for securities fraud, who later said it gave them the strength to carry on in Camp Fed. That is actually a very good use of that book, because I have to say, I read about what he went through, and two things happen. One, I say, I can handle anything. And two, I say, man, I've got no real problems compared to this guy. Wow, how could I be upset? And then Public Citizen says, reparations are coming one way or another. Well, we'll have to investigate that, because I don't know so much. It feels like half the country's into reparations and the other half is staunchly opposed. So as you saw with the January 6th commission, that was supposed to, the 1-6 commission, right? Like the 9/11 commission that was supposed to be voted on here this past week. With the 9/11 commission, 99% of the country thought it was a good idea. So it happened. In this case, half the country thought it was a good idea. The other half are either horrified that their own team could be so stupid or kind of silently cheering on the Capitol riots. And so nothing happened. So in the case of reparations, I'm inclined to think that maybe nothing will happen, because there's still a lot of people who are opposed to it and a lot of politicians who I think can make a good impression by opposing it. But anyway, we are back and we're here to talk about someone who does not understand the meditation that we just did. And that is this lecturer from Yale. So this comes to us from The Federalist. I just chose this because it was the best of the 27 articles that have been written about this all over all conservative media, but it's a good story. So listen to this. So lecturer at Yale fantasizes about brutally murdering white people, right? And I'm not here, by the way, to talk about, oh my God, it's so horrible, they're coming for white people. No, I have a different reason I'm bringing this up. So Yale University, The Federalist writes, one of America's most elite institutions, hosted a racist lecturer who expressed deep-seated animus against white people. When I read the quotes, you'll see that deep-seated animus doesn't begin to describe it. So, it's an official lecture called The Psychopathic Problem of the White Mind, given by Aruna Kilanani at the Yale School of Medicine's Department of Child Study Center. Kilanani, by the way, is a child psychologist. Hello, do you speak Trump? Welcome to the stream. So, Kilanani graphically described her fantasy about killing and burying white people, saying, quote, I had fantasies of unloading a revolver into the heads of any white person who got in my way, burying the body and wiping my bloody hands as I walked away, relatively guiltless with a bounce in my step, like I did the world a favor. And, of course, when the Federalist inquired about the comment, Kilanani responded saying, you're having a psychoanalyst talk about fantasy in relationship to writing. Everyone has fantasies, dreams, nightmares. Not being in contact with your unconscious is what causes problems. In order to fully understand what I'm saying, Yale would have to release the full video. Here's the real story. How did Substack get audio of my talk, referring to Barry Weiss and her Substack, who published this? They were the first ones to publish this story. How did Substack get audio of my talk immediately? Radically misunderstanding the nature of Substack, because that's not how Substack didn't obtain anything. Barry Weiss, or maybe Katie Herzog, obtained this and then published it on Substack, which is a blogging platform. After months of me, Aruna Kilanani, trying to obtain a copy and then have Yale release it, this perpetuates the suppression of voices of people of color. I would love to have shared my story first, but at the end of the day, it comes down to Barry Weiss and Linda Mays. But talking about how two white women have immediate access to my work, with me being on the sideline of my content in my story, is the real racism, right? So, I would guess that some of my conservative viewers would say, oh my God, unbelievable, I can't believe she would say this, look what's happening to America's universities, right? Okay, fair enough. we can address that some other time. That's not really the question right now. The question right now is, what is she so angry at? She's angry at white people, right? But I didn't do anything to her. I never met this person. She has no way of knowing anything about me. I could be the nicest guy in the world. I could be secretly sending her money all the time and she would never know who I was. So she's angry at like an idea, an abstraction. She's angry not at me as a white person. She's not angry at probably any of the white people she sees walking down the street, not individually. She's angry at an abstraction, and a very fuzzy one at that, by the way. I mean, are Turkish people white? What about Southern Italians? People from the middle of the Mediterranean? Not quite Europe, not quite Africa, right? What about people from Eastern Siberia? Are they white? Mongolians? They kind of look white, but they kind of don't. So is she angry at those people? Or is she angry at them in the United States? There's a lot of questions here. She is an object lesson in the value of philosophy, as we were just talking about it in the last hour. She is an object lesson in not understanding herself. She sees the object of her oppression, the subject of her oppression, she's the object of the oppression. She sees it outside herself. She says, if only those people out there would behave differently, I would be okay. And so what she's done is voluntarily enslave herself to the behavior of this abstract group called white people. She cannot be free. She cannot be okay. And frankly, my response to this, to someone like this, to all of these people, by the way, the same thing goes for that video that was floating around of that guy. He's like standing in among some trees or some bushes or something, and he's yelling at some people off screen, hey, why don't you go back to your country? Go back to China or something. Same thing goes for that guy. I just couldn't find him before this episode started, but this was right in front of me. So these are people who think that, oh, the problem is out there. These are people who have not read Viktor Frankl. These are people who don't understand. The problem is not out there. The problem is in here. Another, just a side note, this person is a mental health professional, which that's a little concerning. I feel bad for her because she's very angry and she doesn't understand what she's angry at. Because her anger comes from within. The anger is my choice based on my story that I tell myself, right? Viktor Frankl had a lot more reason to be angry than she does. But Viktor Frankl didn't choose to get angry. Viktor Frankl chose to do something with his pain and suffering. And I aspire to be more like Viktor Frankl and to never be like this person. But she sets herself up as a mental health professional for children. No fake televangelist miracle worker pretending to have old ladies cured of being in wheelchairs could ever do so much damage as somebody with these credentials and that attitude. Right? I feel bad. The proper response to my way of thinking to someone like this is pity. Someone who just is angry and doesn't understand why she's so upset. And she's created this locus for her anger that is frankly not related. There's nothing that I or any other white person could do that would assuage her anger. And she will probably, unless she has some like great mystical come to God experience, she's probably going to die just as angry, regardless what reparations or reforms or anything are done. The smugness of white people who live in gated communities, even the racist ones, the openly racist ones who hate and fear black people, those are not her problem. Her problem is that her soul is full of that self-same hate she condemns. She has no virtue, and so she remains ignorant even of why she's angry. So let's take a look at the chat here. This is interesting. Sibri says, I saw it on New York Post. Public Citizen says, there's a huge mental toll to racism that conservatives do not understand. Or if they do acknowledge it, they often blame the media for exaggerating the effect. Or they blame people themselves from suffering from this racially induced neurosis. It's a thing I've seen repeatedly. She needs to be criticized for this and understood. Interesting. the mental toll to racism that conservatives don't understand. Well, I guess I... Look, okay, I remember talking to Dr. Rod Graham, and he kind of elucidated something very similar to what I think you're saying here. But the point is not to say that her claims are illegitimate. The point is not to say, oh, white people are not racist. What is she talking about? No, the point is to say that if I'm super angry like this, even if I'm in terrible circumstances, it doesn't mean that I have to be angry. It doesn't mean that I have to suffer. Like the Buddha said, being that angry or holding resentment in my heart is like drinking poison and hoping they die. She seems to think that by fantasizing about emptying revolvers into white people that she's actually going to hurt someone. But like Socrates said, even if she had all the power in the world and she threw me in prison and caused me great grief and murdered my family, ultimately she can do all of those things, but she cannot harm me. Same goes for the guy yelling, go back to China. He can insult you and maybe come after you and attack you, but ultimately he cannot harm you. He cannot humiliate you. Only you can humiliate you. Eleanor Roosevelt said, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. And she's a Roosevelt, so she's got great credentials. I'm not a fan of the Roosevelts personally, but that was a pretty good little quote right there. So Sibri says you can really only blame the media for exaggerating and amplifying it. Well, in this case, I'm exaggerating and amplifying it because I wanted to make a point about philosophy. But in general, I see where you're coming from. Conservatives lost the universities several decades ago. Good point. I would call Asians white, most of Asia. Okay, fair enough. Not really germane to the topic at hand, though. Public Citizen says, we are judging her based on comments out of context. What she is saying is toxic, and so no, she is not free from her demons, but the only way to cure demons is to take note of them. That is a good point. It's, to me, there's two sides to this, right? The first is, she is an object lesson in what we were talking about before. That there are other people who have suffered some of the worst things that can ever happen to a person, like Viktor Frankl, being literally in the Holocaust. And he did not respond this way. Whereas she's responded to lesser injustice, if we're going to try to set up some standard of injustice, and she's responded with greater anger. I'm saying the reason why is because she's really not clear with what's going on with her. She has not examined herself. She has not looked within. As Lao Tzu said, to conquer others requires force, but to conquer myself, that is true strength. And that's the true strength that she's really lacking. So take note of them. That might be good. I feel like she should be visiting a mental health professional instead of being one. So if she doesn't move on from this mindset, then she is doomed. But my argument is that Viktor Frankl himself certainly dealt with these same emotions. Absolutely. That's actually a good point. So in this case, we would say Viktor Frankl maybe went through a period of tremendous anger, which I believe he does talk about in the book, a period of great hatred. But ultimately, he learns how to do something with it and to do something productive with it. And I, you know what? I hope that this lady does have some kind of mystical come to God experience or some kind of moment of clarity, some nirvana descending enlightenment, opening up the mandala of true universal knowledge occurs within her. And she realizes that the root of her of injustice, the line between good and evil, cuts through the inside of the human heart. I hope so. Dan Stewart says so many white and people of color in these institutions are afraid to criticize Dr. Kilanani. Cowards. Well, I would say that it's easy to look at it from the outside and say, oh my God, look at these people. Why don't they just say something? Why don't they just tell her to shut up, right? But I know that in like my own workplace, I don't talk about politics. I don't, and people, they don't say stuff quite like this, but they've said some stuff before along these lines, or from a similar direction. And I don't say anything, because I'm just here to work and make money. I'm not here to win some battle of the virtues. And I know that me saying, oh my God, don't talk like that, is not going to do anything meaningful. So, I mean, by and large, I think these people are going along to get along. And that's what the vast majority of people are going to do. And we can call it cowardice if we so desire, but we should be very clear on how we would act if we were in the same situation. Would we call out someone saying something like this, even if it meant significant personal consequences? Right? Alice says, anger is often a second emotion covering something deeper. Sadness, pain, etc. Yeah, I would definitely say so. This lady's definitely got some serious pain, and she's choosing to express it in lectures at Yale, which is odd, frankly. But I think you're absolutely right, that generally anger is a way to cover up something that's a little bit harder to deal with. So, Sibri says, some jobs it's perfectly fine to talk politics, others less so. And Public Citizen says, as a teacher, I never talk politics. That is probably a good idea, Public Citizen. Sibri, I'm not sure what jobs you're talking about where it's safe to talk politics. Maybe if everyone at your job agrees with you on everything, then it's a good idea to talk politics. Or if you are a professional philosopher, then maybe that would work. But other than that, I don't know, man. That sounds pretty dangerous to me. And then Sibri says, all my teachers ever did was talk politics. I actually had a teacher in high school who, when we did, he was a great teacher. He was the best teacher I've ever seen in my life. And I took comparative government from him senior year of high school. And he was this little short dude, like 5'4", big giant curly white beard, like a gnome version of Karl Marx. But he was not a Marxist. And even though we talked politics the whole semester, no one could ever figure out what his position was. So when we did the unit on communism and I was 17, I was like, you know what? I'm a communist. This is super convincing. This is awesome. And then we did the segment after that, which is on all the problems with communism. And then I was like, ah, yeah, you know what? You're right. A mixed economy is best. And then we talked about capitalism. I was like, oh, I'm a capitalist now. I believe in the free market. And so he talked politics all semester, but we never knew what his position was. No one could figure out what he was. And we all tried. Because we were all, me and my friends were all Democrats at that time. Because George Bush was president and we were anti-imperialism. So, and then Sibri says math teachers always stayed away. Basically the only ones. I don't know that they necessarily always do that anymore. If campusreform.com is to be believed. And then Dan Stewart says, that's funny. I have a friend who's a teacher that teaches socialism instead of the curriculum. That sounds a little dangerous. It's like he might get in trouble for that. But anyway, so that is that. And that is, Public Citizen says, I used to talk about Trump back in 2015, 2016, and I really alienated so many students. Never again. Issues are cool, but not politics. And extremists should not be in the classroom. Well, you know what? I would agree with you. I would make a slight change, however. Instead of extremists, I would say ideologues, even if they're not extremists. Because you could be an extremist, right? Like, I could be a communist. But if I really believe in teaching the curriculum properly, even though I'm an extremist, like, revolutionary communist, I might still go in and do my job well. But if I'm an ideologue, if I'm someone whose entire life is dedicated to my political ideas, if I'm someone who really takes Lenin seriously when he says the personal is the political, then maybe I shouldn't be in a classroom because maybe I'm going to teach socialism or whatever I'm an extremist on instead of the curriculum. Like I had Shane Hazel on this past Tuesday, and he is an anarchist and he is a bit of a firebrand. I brought up guns and he said some very scary things about come and take them. I know exactly how I would go to war with the government to keep them from taking my guns, like scary stuff. I agree with like 80% of what that guy says when he talks about the economy and the role of government. I still wouldn't really want him teaching my children because he is a bit of an ideologue. And I say that in the nicest way. We love you, Shane Hazel. Thank you for coming on the show. But he is a bit of a firebrand, and maybe those people should not be the ones teaching students. Maybe the ones teaching students should be people who believe in the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake, right? But Anyway, so to move on to our kind of next topic here. So this is super interesting. Some of you have probably seen this already, but I found this at Human Events and actually a bunch of other places, including Undark magazine. And it goes to, as long as we're talking about government and anarchism and ideologues and libertarianism, this is interesting. So it's a public safety app called Citizen. So, public citizen, perhaps you will appreciate it, perhaps not. I, as host of the show Socratic Citizen, appreciate the call out. I'm going to pretend that it's my namesake. But Human Events calls it Orwellian. An Orwellian public safety app called Citizen may put users in more danger. So, Citizen, a startup looking to make it big, is a public safety smartphone app that sends alerts about incidents occurring nearby. Recently, however, its business has entered into harrowing new territory, raising concerns among law enforcement officials and employees. In attempts to delve into different areas of safety, Citizen is causing alarm among experts, who say the company seems to be acting too aggressively. According to NBC News in Los Angeles, people saw what appeared to be a law enforcement SUV with Citizen's logo. It turned out to be a test of a private security force for people willing to pay a monthly fee, and it was quickly denounced on social media as a dystopian idea that could interfere with the 911 system. So, when Shane Hazel came on last Tuesday, he said, you know what I think we should do is privatize the police. Privatize the police. That's how you solve problems of police violence. Turns out, somebody's trying to do it. So this app is very, very interesting. So here's what it actually does. So let's skip this part. Where's the part where they say what it actually does? Let's go over here. This is from undark.org. So on October 26th, 2020... police killed Walter Wallace Jr. in West Philadelphia as his mother stood on the sidewalk, pleading for his life. Over the next few days, the neighborhood erupted in protest and my phone lit up with alerts from Citizen, a public safety app. Writers for the app monitor and transcribe police scanner chatter, which is then converted into push notifications. There was a break-in at Rite Aid, a burglary at a nearby liquor store, a dumpster fire one block over, a trash fire 900 feet away. As local news has been decimated by budget cuts and layoffs, apps like Citizen and Nextdoor have ascended to fill the void. Interesting. So it looks like new versions of what previously existed in the form of local news are rising up. Now, I, of course, being a bit of a libertarian myself, want to talk about how this is a triumph of the market and that ultimately, if all the police are defunded, things like these will rise up to replace them. That this is, in fact, a rather community-based form of policing and something I'm inclined to be sympathetic to. And Dan Stewart points out perhaps the main criticism of this app. He says there was a map app that gave directions to people seeking to avoid bad neighborhoods, and it was charged as racist. And that's one of the main charges against this app, that it is racist, because here's how it works. I was trying to find it in the article, but I'm just going to tell you. So the way it works is I download this app and then I've got it on my phone. And so what I can do is I can live stream from my phone on to the system that this app has created. So I can go, oh, look, there's people breaking into a Rite Aid. I break up my phone and I film it, or I write a little thing that says, hey, three men, all about equal height, with one with blonde hair, one's Mexican, and one's black, and they're all robbing this store. It's on the corner of 7th Avenue and State Street. And so originally, the app was called Vigilante, and it billed itself as being for citizens who wanted to take the law into their own hands. So I would see, oh, they're breaking into the Rite Aid down the street. I'm going to go do something about it. But Apple banned them from the App Store for encouraging violence. So they rebranded themselves as Citizen. And somewhere in here it says the app for the professional bystander. So they just rebranded so that they wouldn't get out of the App Store. Who in Paris says you look gay? Aren't you hilarious? This is the guy we want to listen to, folks. I take back my entire stream because Who in Paris is going to talk for me with these radically insightful posts in my chat. And you've never heard of the painting behind me. I think I'm too gay to answer your questions, Who's in Paris, but thanks for playing. Anyway, so I will be turning in Who's in Paris using my version of the Citizen app for committing some form of low-level social terrorism. But more importantly, the app rebranded itself to avoid getting kicked out of the Apple Store because Apple obviously can't be seen to be encouraging people to take the law into their own hands. So, in this case, it's really just about people reporting crimes. But of course, the accusation is that people will report Black people for just going about their lives and say that they're committing crimes, say that they're being suspicious. And I believe somewhere in this article, it has that in here. This article's too long. I can't find my way through it. She says somewhere in the article, so let's say I'm going running down the street at night, and I see a man who is suspicious to me, and let's say he's Black, and then I do a post on Citizen about it. What exactly happens to that guy, right? It's not really clear, but no, Who's in Paris, I am not an app developer. I am actually just here to talk about the social ramifications of this Citizen app. But anyway, so the key here is, it might be racist. But of course, we have to counter that with all of the accusations of police racism that have been leveled over the past few decades. And we have to ask ourselves, if this is dangerous, dangerous compared to what? Compared to police? Colin Cunningham says, I wish I could have walking directions in the city that avoided high crime areas. Now, of course, I have to ask the question, are you worried that that might make you racist? What if you found that in avoiding high crime areas, you just never went into a Black neighborhood? What if Black neighborhoods, the businesses therein, suffered a loss of business because everyone was using that app? Is it worth it? Or is it too racist? And then Public Citizen says, I have used that app but gave up on it when I realized that a lot of the posts are total garbage. People can post anything without verification. It's really bad for our mental health to be so focused on things like this. My world is not nearly as dangerous as these things would have us believe. Frankly, I'm inclined to agree with you because I'm not inclined towards catastrophism myself. And generally, I'm not really that afraid of criminals. Frankly, I get more nervous around the police than I do around bad neighborhoods, and I've lived near a few bad neighborhoods in my time, but I just kind of went wandering around, maybe what's his name, Mr. Magoo, just going about his business, and there could be stabbings happening all around me, and I was just not aware of it. But anyway, so point being, this app represents a step towards the privatization of police, and I think it represents one of the most interesting possible solutions to the problems with policing that have been brought up, mostly by people on the left, but also by libertarians. While solutions kind of elude us so far, and one of the reasons that solutions elude us, by the way, is because defund the police as a slogan and as a policy prescription ignores a fundamental fact about any government entity. Any government entity faced with budget cuts will cut the most important stuff first. So if I'm a business owner and revenue falls and I have to start cutting stuff, I cut the least important stuff, right? I cut that second HR representative and I cancel the company Christmas party because I want to keep the core operations going, because I want to be around next year when revenue goes back up. I don't want to go out of business. I can't take away the most important stuff we do. The incentive is in the opposite direction for government entities. If I am some agency and Congress or the state legislature cuts my budget, what's it in my interest to do? To cut the least important stuff? No. What's in my interest to do is to stop doing the most visible and important stuff I can possibly find not to do. So then when the news comes along and goes, oh, isn't it interesting? The police have failed to solve crimes. The police failed to prevent crimes. The cops go, well, you took our money. What are we supposed to do? Meanwhile, they're still handing out the same number of traffic tickets. They're still prosecuting the same number of drug crimes. But they've stopped prosecuting homicides. They've stopped doing wellness checks. They've stopped intervening in domestic violence disputes because that stuff is visible and it's going to make the public lobby the legislature to give them their money back. It's just a function of economic incentives. And for people, for the police and for any other government entity, as soon as you defund them, they're going to stop doing the most important stuff first. So when we say, for example, look at all these cities that defunded the police, look at Minneapolis, Seattle, Portland, New York City, and the high crime rates that have resulted, assuming, of course, that those high crime rates are a direct result of defunding police. I'm sure there's a zillion other factors as well, COVID lockdowns, whatever. But to the extent that they are a result of defunding police, it's because police departments, recognizing where their interests lie, because, hey, they're human beings with economic interests, they cut the most important stuff first. And they continue to do meaningless stuff. They don't fire any bureaucrats. They don't shrink down the size of their administration departments. No, they don't respond to every fourth 911 call. Oops, we don't have enough resources to respond to it. Because that's how they get their budget back. And as you can see in the New York mayoral race right now, the two people that are leading, one's an ex-cop whose name I forget, the other is Andrew Yang. They're the two most conservative Democrats in the race. Because New Yorkers, faced with high crime rates and a police force that has spent the last year being defunded and demonized, has said, hey, if you're going to take our money and demonize us, we might as well let you get beat up on the subway. Because it's in their interests to do so. So, who's in Paris says, do you stand anywhere politically? I don't affiliate with any party. If anything, I would be kind of libertarian leaning. I like to say I have an anarchist soul. So sometimes I agree with Democrats, sometimes I agree with Republicans, but in general, I think they're both a blight on America. So Dan Stewart says, to avoid accusations of racism, the San Francisco Police Department posted a video of a crime seeking the public's help, except they blurred the faces of the perps. So they blurred the faces of the perps to such an extent that you couldn't tell what race they were? Is that where this is going? I'm not sure. I mean, I get what you're saying, that police are out there doing performative things to try and convince people that there's no racism in police. But frankly, I'm not convinced that racism is the main problem with police, right? Who's in Paris says police is corrupted, but the ones accusing police of corruption are even more corrupted. Well, it depends on who you're talking about. Like, if you're talking about some of these people that are known as, like the race hustlers, like, I think his name is Benjamin Crump, and he always, like, appears out of the ground as soon as, like, he just pops up and suddenly appears. As soon as there any black person suffers any kind of violence at the hands of the police, and he's always there to sue the police and do this and do that, and he strikes me as the civil rights equivalent of those cheesy televangelists I was talking about earlier, who pretend that they can do miracles. Who's in Paris says, America 2021, we should abolish the police, we don't need it. I feel like there might be some sarcasm here in some of these comments. I'm just not sure which part is sarcastic. But I get your point, because what I've discovered is when I go and talk to people on the left, I often agree with their critiques of police. Qualified immunity being a great example. It's very difficult to sue the police if they violate your constitutional rights. And that, to me, seems like kind of like wrong. Like, it shouldn't, that's not a good way to build a society. If you want the police to behave themselves, there has to be a mechanism for holding them accountable when they don't behave themselves. And, oh, the chief will yell at them and fire them if they're bad. That does not convince me of anything, because police departments are famously insular, self-protecting. That's what the thin blue line is. The thin blue line that nobody crosses, including when we're trying to have a trial for a cop who's done something wrong. There has to be real accountability. And to me, real accountability would look like something like, I can sue you if you break into my house illegally, right? At the very least that. But when I listen to the left talk about their solutions to the problems with policing, then I feel like sometimes they veer off into fantasy land. Like this Alex Vitale. I was talking about this earlier. The guy's doing an interview and he's saying all this really good stuff about all the problems with policing. And he says, like, for example, the profession of policing as it's currently advertised, like it attracts the people, like it tends to suck in people who are more likely to do violence. But then later on, he's like, here's what we need to do. We need to abolish the police, find different solutions in policing, and one of the things that we can do is enact more gun control. And I'm thinking, dude, there's a disconnect here. What are you talking about? Who's going to enforce the gun control if you get rid of the police? So I don't, it's like it just, they veer off into fantasy land where handing out welfare checks to people, taxing away all of Jeff Bezos' money and handing it out in all the worst districts in Chicago, New York, LA, Atlanta, whatever, that's going to solve crime. That's our answer. That's what we're going to do. That doesn't make any sense. Because, look, I recognize that a lot of people are like, look, people are fundamentally good. They're put in bad situations. They're desperate. They have mental health issues that don't get treated. And so they go out and commit crime. Okay, fair enough. Those people definitely exist. And if we as communities came together and found ways to deal with those people, we would take a chunk out of violent crime. Absolutely correct. But that doesn't mean that if you just had enough mental hospitals and counselors and social workers, that no guy would ever get drunk on a Friday night and beat his wife because he's got demons inside. We talked about the lady wanting to empty revolvers into white people and how she's really not, she hasn't dealt with her demons, and she's a mental health professional. She's not exactly some dweeb walking down the street in a bad neighborhood. This is a person who has some serious demons. This is a person who I would not want to see intoxicated, because I might fear for my life a little bit. Give her a bottle of gin and a revolver, and I'm afraid for my life. No matter how good the mental health services in the local community are, getting better mental health services might be great, but it's not going to solve the problem. You're not going to get rid of crime. So what do you do? Personally, I'm kind of a fan of the neighborhood watch kind of thing. So to my way of thinking, if you want to fix the police, then what you need to do is expand the Second Amendment and encourage people, hey, defending yourself and your property is like your responsibility. You have to be ready to defend yourself. And if that means go get a gun, then go get a gun. If it means put a lock on your door and hope for the best, then you can do that too. That's actually a pretty good deterrent. Or get one of those creepy Amazon Ring camera doorbell things. That might be a good deterrent, but it's up to you. Because, as Vitale points out, the police don't solve a ton of crimes. Most crimes go unsolved. And he points to something that I've never watched. I think it's called The First 48. It's like a reality show about the police and how they like have 48 hours to nail down a suspect in a murder case. And they just do murder case after murder case. And it's like the first 2 days, if they don't get somebody in the first 2 days, they close the case or something. Who's in Paris says, I want to see all those lefties who call the fascist police or who call the police fascist in order to stop the fascists. Oh, they call the fascist police in order to stop the fascists. Yeah, there's not a lot of consistency here. Now, to be fair to the lefties, that is a bit of a straw man of the lefty argument. I know you can find people on Twitter who really do make this argument, But also there are people with a more sophisticated understanding who are on the left, people like this Vitaly, who I'm reading right now, but I still don't think his solutions make a ton of sense. Dan Stewart says, the squad called for defunding the police, but supported a $1 billion increase for the Capitol Police. Well, that's not surprising, because the squad are Instagram stars. And at least two of them were ranked among the least effective people in all of Congress. That's AOC and Ilhan Omar, who have gotten zero bills passed that have their names on it. Who's in Paris says, we should abolish the police in New York or Oregon. Oregon, parentheses, crackheads, for 6 months. Let's see what's going to happen. Well, I'm sure that you would find that satisfying, but I would feel bad for all the people in Oregon who don't want to see that happen. Like the eastern two-thirds of the state that's trying to secede from Oregon and move over. They want to become part of Idaho now because they don't like the policies of coastal Oregon. But on the other hand, let's also abolish the police in some little middle-of-nowhere town where society kind of works on its own. Because that, I think, would be very successful. I think it'd be very successful abolishing the police in middle-of-nowhere Nebraska. And it would be a net benefit. So, Dan Stewart says, when seconds count, the police are only minutes away. Yes, thank you for that. Public Citizen said, I don't know about you, but I don't live in a gated community, and I would feel better if people with demons can see the needed exorcists. Well, yes, I agree with you. I mean, mental health, people with mental health problems should see mental health doctors. What I don't believe is that you can solve, that represents a replacement for the police. You can't just say, let's abolish the police and build more hospitals and mental health facilities, and then everything will be fine. Like, for example, let me see if I can find this here. Yeah, this is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez making that argument, and this, I think, is incorrect.
If we want to reduce violent crime, if we want to reduce the number of people in our jails, the answer is to... If we want to reduce violent crime, if we want to reduce the number of people in our jails, the answer is to stop building more of them. The answer is to make sure that we actually build more hospitals, we pay organizers, we get people mental health care and overall health care, employment, etc. It's to support communities, not throw them away.
So that's what we're kind of arguing against here. That's what I'm saying doesn't work. Oh, just stop building jails and give people mental health support. It's not enough. You need something to catch those people that are still going to commit crimes. Those people whose thought process is something like, hey, that person has something that I want, and I know I'll get away with it, so I'm going to take it from them. Those people do exist. And sentencing them to more counseling is not going to change that. Because our closest relatives in the world are the chimpanzees. And if you look at chimpanzee behavior, you see that sometimes they just like to steal things because they want them and they think they're going to get away with it. And there are enforcement mechanisms within the chimpanzee troop. The chimpanzees will fight each other. Even members of the same tribe will fight each other. If an alpha male of a chimpanzee troop becomes too violent, the other males in the troop will band together and kill him as punishment for being too violent, for abusing his power. Mental health does not cover all the bases. There's more to it than just that. Alice says, I agree with Public Citizen. Having been on Nextdoor app, I don't want this people having guns. I guess I should spend some time on the Nextdoor app. I've never been on it, and I really don't know what exactly you are talking about. Public Citizen says, she is right, assume you're talking about AOC. Now, don't get me wrong here. I'm not arguing for mass incarceration or that the police should be used to solve mental health problems. Absolutely not. She's right, but it's not enough. Right? She's got it. We can take a glass half full approach and say she's halfway there. But let's not forget the empty half of the glass as well. That's the point I'm trying to make. Dan Stewart, the solution for problems with police is killing police culture. Licensed, insured, and federally regulated. And then he says, pass laws like control person liability. Okay, so for those who don't know, because I've talked to Dan Stewart about this before, but control person liability means that, like, if I am a police chief and then you are a street cop and you commit a crime, you murder somebody or you plant drugs on somebody and you get caught, I'm liable. Right? Just like in a corporation, if I know that one of my underlings at work is committing crimes and I don't do anything about it, I'm liable as well. If you commit a homicide and I know about it, I can get in trouble for not telling on you. And they would do so. Control person liability means whoever's in charge, they're liable as well. Failure to supervise, aiding and abetting, accessory after the fact. So all of these things are kind of, I imagine, on a similar kind of track. Though I don't know, what's the difference between control person liability and failure to supervise? Aiding and abetting is obvious. Accessory after the fact is obvious. But, so yeah, I mean, those generally sound like good ideas. But anyway, the question we have to ask when we're looking at stuff like what Alice said here, I don't want these people having guns because I've been on the Nextdoor app, is we have to compare those people on the Nextdoor app to the people who are populating police departments. Because what we don't want to do is end up doing this. This is a definition of fascism from Jonah Goldberg's book, Liberal Fascism. And you may not be a fan of Jonah Goldberg, I get it, whatever. His definition of fascism is pretty good. So he says, fascism is a religion of the state. It assumes the organic unity of the body politic and longs for a national leader attuned to the will of the people. It is totalitarian in that it views everything as political and holds that any action by the state is justified to achieve the common good. It takes responsibility for all aspects of life, including our health and well-being, and seeks to impose uniformity of thought and action, whether by force or through regulation and social pressure. Everything, including the economy and religion, must be aligned with its objectives. Any rival identity is part of the problem and therefore defined as the enemy. I will argue that contemporary American liberalism embodies all these aspects of fascism. That last sentence is not really part of this, but it was in the quote, so I read it. So it is not an indictment of liberalism. The indictment is of the worship of the state. So what does that mean? We talked about homeschooling when I had Carrie McDonald on here. And I pointed out that the critique of homeschooling from Elizabeth Barthollet at Harvard University was, oh, people can use homeschooling as a way to get away with abusing their children. So I can take my kids out of school, beat them, lock them in the basement and keep them there and starve them for years on end. And because they never go to school, no teacher's ever going to look at them and go, hey, you're looking kind of skinny there, Jimmy. You getting enough to eat at home? Or you got bruises all over you? Is your dad beating you? And so Barthollet and others like her argue you can't let people homeschool because they can't be trusted. They might use homeschooling to abuse their children. And so if you abuse children, the government comes and takes them away. The question becomes, who takes away the children from the government if the government abuses the children? I can't say for certain, but from what I've read, foster care and orphans' homes and government-run facilities for children who've been taken away from their families are not always the happiest places. I believe Micaiah Bryant, who was shot by a cop after she tried to stab her foster sister there, would probably agree. I'm sure she was not stabbing people because she was in such a tremendous place emotionally and her home life was so fantastic. So who watches them? What we've said is, okay, so there's potential for parents to abuse children, and there's potential for governments to abuse children. But we'll take the government abuse of children over the parental abuse of children. We give the government the power to take the children from the parents and say, well, they might get abused, but hey, we're doing the best we can. Instead of saying, oh, the parents have a sacred right to their children, but parents are going to abuse the children. Well, we're doing the best we can. At some point, you have to say, hey, we're doing the best we can. You can give the guns to professional cops, or you can give them to regular people. Professional cops might be racist, abusive, brutal. They might be corrupt. We go, look, we're doing the best we can. Or you can give the guns to regular people. They're corrupt. They're crazy. They're racist. They believe that Trump actually won the election and he's going to be reinstated as president in August. They read QAnon conspiracy theories on the internet. But hey, we're doing the best we can. In other words, no solution is going to be perfect. But a lot of us are walking around with a little bit of this worship of the state as the answer to all the problems. We assume, hey, if there's a problem and it just can't be fixed, we'll have the government do it. But we don't really look at the problems once we get government involved. And that government monopoly, that unique privilege of the state to use violence goes unquestioned. Because regular people, well, can't be trusted. The government can be trusted, however. So that would be my critique there of that, of this particular sentence. Having been on Nextdoor, I don't want these people having guns. I agree. Sometimes people have guns and it's a little nerve-wracking. But I can't get away from the fact that at least half the time, the people who are nerve-wracking me because they have guns are cops.